studios of KPCW in Park City. This is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, and first this morning, Katie Mullally and I speak with author and entrepreneur Steve Lucas about actual doable uses of AI and the potential benefits for small businesses. His new book is Digital Impact, the Human Element of AI-Driven Transformation. Then we have a conversation with one-time, long-ago local Peter Rizzo about his time as the station doctor for the 77th Australian National Antarctic Research Expedition and what it's like to live and work in Antarctica. Stay tuned for these guests. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
The rapid rise of artificial intelligence has created unparalleled opportunities for organizations to innovate, grow, and make a difference. Yet, many companies are stuck, unable to achieve their full potential because of two pervasive issues, digital fragmentation and data complexity. This creates chaos, making it harder for businesses to connect their systems, harness their data, and make meaningful progress at a time when doing so is more urgent than ever. Joining us to talk about these challenges and his new book, Digital Impact, the Human Element of AI-Driven Transformation, is author Steve Lucas. Steve is a three-time CEO and technology visionary who strives to provide a clear and actionable roadmap to solve these challenges. Well, Steve, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Lynn. I'm excited to join you.
When we talk about AI in business, I think a lot of us think of big corporations, big transportation companies, big, you know, manufacturing, but AI seems to be permeating into all businesses. Is AI specifically in business use something that all businesses, even if you're a mom and pop bakery up to, you know, a Boeing, need to prepare for?
Yes. You know, a couple of days ago, I was hanging out with my now adult kids, but we were rewatching Jurassic Park, the movie we all love from 1993. And the narrative there was the modern world we live in is not capable of handling, you know, dinosaurs from 100 million years ago. That's the man and dinosaur just don't fit. I think similarly, AI, the kind of AI that is being invented now from OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, and the like, this world is not ready for it. It's not. But irrespective of our preparedness or readiness, we will have to embrace it. It's going to have to happen now. You know, when I say blockbuster video, most everybody, especially our generation, we know exactly what that means. Oh, I love it. You know, going to get it. There's nostalgia with it. But blockbuster video in the world of business is a cautionary tale. They weren't ready for technology called the internet, and they went away. And so too, especially small businesses need to contemplate, how can I leverage or use AI to make my business better? Good news, you can.
Well, before we get into these ways to utilize AI, I think that AI, the developers of AI, have a responsibility for showing us the benefits of it. I've had conversations with people that are in AI and they don't understand why we don't all embrace it. And all I can say to them is, you're not giving us a reason. All we are seeing is job loss and basically the machines taking over. So how can AI better market itself to small businesses instead of it just being something that seems to be shoved down our throats?
Well, I think the use cases will become more and more obvious over time. I think, first of all, you know, most technology organizations don't speak in outcomes, they speak in acronyms. So I think that's part of it, right, is number one. Number two is AI is actually about simplicity. It is. It's going to be profoundly simpler for all of us to run our businesses in the future with AI. There's an example I often show for me, is even as a CEO, where how much time do I spend during my week doing things like looking at expense reports? I'm not saying that I'm aloof and I'm so valuable I shouldn't do that. It's just not the most productive use of my time. And if I have a cute little AI assistant that just shows up and says, hey, I looked at the expense report, looks good to me, are you okay with it? And I just say yes. Now that's one example. That's gonna give me back time to be more productive. But let's talk about a small business that makes, you know, a unique product. When I'm shipping those products to customers constantly, there's always problems with shipping. UPS can't do something, FedEx messed up something, the customer doesn't want a thing. And we humans have to think about that. We have to go, oh, okay, well, UPS can't deliver on time and it was 7 packages, gosh, what do I do? An AI agent will be able to figure that out for you and just say, hey, there was a problem with the shipment with UPS, but I already looked at the US Postal Service, FedEx, DHL. I looked at your packages. I made the decision. I've already printed the label. You good? That's happening now. That's powerful. And it's when we get time back to do more things that we will grow our businesses with AI.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Steve Lucas. He's the author of a new book just out and already has made some bestseller lists. It's called Digital Impact, The Human Element of AI-Driven Transformation. Okay, so Steve, let's go back to, I mean, that was a great example of using AI to help you ship your packages. And so you're not going from app to app to app. And you mention in the book that this is a big problem with businesses from small to large, that you're using all these different things that you've got to be the human that checks them. So we want to become the human that employs AI, but how to connect all these separate things you do.
Yeah, so first of all, the reason I originally wrote the book is, let's go back to the statement around, is the world ready for AI? And I think to a large degree, the answer is no. But the no is because we've got these incredibly powerful AI models like ChatGPT. But these amazing new houses are being built with broken or outdated plumbing. And what I mean by that is that the data that we give these models, like a ChatGPT that everybody kind of knows, that data is imperfect. So if you give AI imperfect data, it will make less than perfect decisions or recommendations. It's exactly like a human being. If all I'm giving you is inaccurate information, then you're going to make a poor decision. So we've got to fix the foundation, which is connecting our systems. And for the person listening today, you know, they're going to think, like, just think about, you know, running a small business. My point of sale system, is it connected with my shipping system or is it connected with my website? Most oftentimes the answer is no. And how you connect those systems, then providing good data to AI, it's going to make it better in the end.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm thinking of, I was trying to think of the people who listen to Cool Science Radio as they're driving around in the community. And I thought about contractors or let's say a small or even a large construction company. That happens a lot in Denver and a lot in Park City. There's a lot of building going on. And you mentioned the case of like using AI to help you design a new plumbing or HVAC or whatever it is, or track your estimates or your sales. You're saying that what needs to happen is that all of these things need to be connected. And you say in the book that the SaaS or the software as a service, this is going to go away because we're no longer going to be subscribing to all of these different software that help us perform, right?
Yep.
We're going to instead, as a contractor, we are going to instead do what?
Well, here's what's going to happen. I can't help. It's kind of like if you remember the movie The Matrix, where the protagonist Neo, when he finally wakes up, he walks around and all he sees is a world constructed of ones and zeros, right? Is that digital world. Well, I can't help it anymore because all I will do is I walk around and I see how AI is changing or going to change everything. I had a guy come out for my daughter, my daughter's house. She wanted a deck with a pergola in the back. Great. But she still called dad. So dad comes out. I come out and I'm standing in the backyard and I watch as the guy, brilliant guy who's going to build it for us. He's measuring everything. He's, you know, typing some stuff in and he's spreadsheeting and that kind of thing. And he goes, great. In a couple of days, I'll get a quote back to you. That's what happened, right? And my daughter just felt better because dad was there, even though I know I'm literally doing next to zero things to help. I'm just standing there. But then I thought for a moment, with an AI, what we call an agent, which is a small packaged version of AI, it could instantly, with a few inputs, tell me and him exactly what the quote's going to be without any effort. It would just say, great, here's your dimensions, take a few pictures, it'll figure it out. That is changing everything. So whether it's scheduling and job coordination across crews and trucks and tools and materials on a job site, just asking AI, hey, two people didn't show up today, how's that going to push the project back? It doesn't matter. These thousands of examples, they can be automated now. And my company and what I wrote in the book is this is achievable without propeller heads and developers. We've made it so you can just do this now.
Well, Steve, what I love about your book and the title as well is the human component. And we've talked to so many authors and scientists about how people are starting to go, oh, wait, we forgot about humans over here. They need to be part of this. And so your subtitle, The Human Element of AI-Driven Transformation, how do you see that human element?
Well, I think we've all forgotten that software exists to help us, not to burden us. I believe firmly that we don't tell the stories about amazing ways that our lives are better because of technology. If you look at in the book, we talk about the American Cancer Society, and obviously their mission is to eliminate cancer. But one of the biggest challenges, if I said, hey, what do you think one of the biggest challenges is for senior citizens getting the important care they need when they're stricken with cancer? You probably wouldn't say it's getting a ride to the treatment. But that's one of the top issues, especially for senior citizens, because they don't use Uber. Like, we just say, oh, you take an Uber. They don't Uber. That's not a thing. And so the American Cancer Society came up with a solution where they could use technology to make sure that amongst many people, seniors that desperately need life-saving care, just get a ride, an automated system to get them to the important chemotherapy that they need. And we don't tell those stories about how technology can radically change outcomes. So the human element is, it asks and begs a big question, which is, we should always start, when we start talking about technology like AI, let's not marvel at the technology, let's marvel at how it helps us. How do we get more time? How do we become more human in this process? And here's the last thing I'll ask all everybody listening. Let's say AI gives us more time back. We're more productive. What do we do with the extra time? Is it more work or could we be more human in the process?
Wow, this is truly one of the first conversations I've had with somebody about AI that makes me feel good about it, because in the past and even current conversations, AI is here to take away jobs and simplify and streamline. This is such a great way to frame it and look at it and help all of us understand that AI actually can have a role in all of our lives. We'll talk about the role of AI in disaster relief, especially as bigger and more natural disasters happen.
Yeah. Well, it's another, for the listeners, I'm sure everyone will remember the wildfires going on in Australia a few years ago. And the Australian Red Cross, prior to those wildfires, think like the day before, they had to respond to like 30 incidents a day across the entirety of Australia. Australia's a big place, right? The day the wildfires hit, they had to respond to 300,000. Not 30. That's an order of magnitude plus, right? So when you think about when disaster strikes, is my organization, is my company prepared to respond to that immediate difference in scale? The answer is generally no. In this case, we wrote about how technology, a specific a platform from my company called Boomi, helped them to instantly scale to 300,000 incidents a day. That's the kind of scale you can get. But again, it's not about what we shouldn't marvel at that. What we should marvel at is the lives they saved because of it. And that's really the outcome that we're all looking for, is how does technology help us save lives, help get people the care that they need? And when I think about AI, there is this thing I think about a lot. It's the notion that, and there's a sub element in the book around humans becoming superhuman. That we don't, because you are exactly right, Katie. We jump too quickly to, oh my gosh, AI, humans are gonna lose jobs. Well, what about the thing that might happen in the middle, which is we become superhuman. Mm-hmm. If we can respond to disasters instantly, if we can help people get the care that they need. By the way, if you had asked me 2 years ago, would you be able to just go to some place and ask this wizard in the sky, hey, how should I think about generating the next life-saving drug? I would think that was like 20, 30 years away. And here we are in 2025. We are superhumans. We are unrecognizable, our knowledge and capability today, from even 2 or 3 years ago.
Huh, interesting. Well, let's go into a supply chain that you talk about in the book that's really interesting. And this is about how AI can help us with supply chain transparency, but it's the example of how to combat child labor in West African cocoa farming. That's getting really specific. What is that all about?
Well, there are several things there. In my book, I talk about West African farmers working these small rural plots are using technology and, you know, AI and integration to transform how they operate. Explicitly why I chose that is these aren't billion-dollar agribusinesses. These are real farmers using mobile phones to access crop pricing, get predictive weather alerts, and coordinate some supply deliveries, all powered through connected systems. So what's the result? There's less waste, there's better yields, and more stable incomes for the farmers. That is powerful, right? That's what AI can do. It's not just about automating work for the intergalactic agribusinesses out there, but creating real opportunity in the places that people need it most. And all I would say, the reason for that example beyond the human element is encouraging everyone, every small business out there, experiment now. We don't want to go the way of the dinosaur as small businesses. Small businesses are the fuel, are the energy that power the US and global economy, frankly. But part of that is every single person with an earshot should be experimenting with AI to help improve their business now.
So Steve, let's say I'm a small ski shop here in Park City, supply chain issues, you know, customer issues, forecasting the future with how much inventory to bring in. How could I bring in AI to help with my business get ready for next season? Because these are what we have here, these little small businesses.
Well, there's a lot of ways. I think first of all is, you know, if you take, like every ski shop is going to have a spreadsheet or some type of reservation management system. There's going to be something that they have, right? So I think you could take that data, like literally just copy and paste. Everybody can do that. And ask AI, you could pick a tool, Anthropic's Claude or ChatGPT, to predict what gear, what sizes, what styles are most likely to be in demand based on the weather patterns, tourist data, and past seasons. And you actually don't need to have much of that data, right? You just have your own, like what you support. Just ask the question. It's going to help reduce overstock, understock. That's a perfect example. Another one would be just asking AI to recommend the best gear based on, you know, your customers. If you're not collecting things like height, weight of your, maybe you don't want to collect weight, but collect the height, you know, and or general sizes from your customers, skill level, snow conditions. Just a little bit of that data could go a long way. But you could also do things on your website, like have an AI-driven chatbot that allows customers to ask about rental snow conditions and book gear. And you can do that with just a simple AI chatbot, and that's about it. There are lots of cool AI-powered applications for small businesses. The ski shops, there's actually companies that specialize in AI for ski shops now. So those are actual things, but it's right there for us to use. And I just, what I worry about is, I do worry about that ski shop, because I know what, this is going to sound so, I know what companies like the Walmarts of the world are doing. I know what companies, these large retailers, I know what they're doing. They have these massive rooms full of hundreds, thousands of people working on AI. They're going to create this ridiculously, disproportionately high competitive advantage because of their deep pockets. AI can be the equalizer. It can be for small business. So I think it is, I think you asked the right question, Katie, but that's where you got to experiment with it now and find new ways to help you thrive, not just survive.
So one more question, Steve. I'm that small ski shop owner and I want to learn about AI. I want to incorporate it into my business model. Where does someone go to start down this path?
I would say, you know, first of all, it's experimentation. But before you go anywhere else, go to ChatGPT, number one. And then number two is just ask it, say, and this is the best part about AI, is say, I'm a small business owner. I have a ski shop. Take me through everything. Ask me questions, not the other way around. And help me use you, AI, to create competitive advantage. You will go down an amazing journey. And that journey will be AI asking you about your business, about your customer. Just tell it to ask you. You can even enter a prompt to say, act as an amazing AI consultant for my small business. Take me on this journey. Spend 2 hours there. Your worldview at the end will be profoundly different. Now, wow. There's lots of other blogs and TikTok channels and YouTube channels that you can rely on. I think there's one one called Guy in a Cube. There's another one called Modern Millie. But there's some really good ones out there. And if you for people that use technologies like HubSpot, which is, you know, commonly used in a lot of small and medium-sized businesses, they have something on academy.hubspot.com. But again, I would just say AI is your friend. Go introduce yourself. Probably be nice to it in case it ends up ruling the earth. But introduce yourself. Have the conversation.
And I think they can also read your book, Digital Impact, The Human Element of AI-Driven Transformation, because there is a lot of useful, practical information that I think everyone can gain something from. So our guest today has been Steve Lucas. He is a 3-time CEO and a technology visionary, and again, the author of the new book, Digital Impact, The Human Element of AI-Driven Transformation. Well, Steve, thank you for putting AI into a perspective that even I can appreciate, because I've been very anti-AI, but this will help me change my mind.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Katie, and thank you, Lynn. It's been a real pleasure.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Antarctica is home to 44 research stations, all staffed by people from around the globe. But in order to conduct the vital and varied research at these end-of-the-world locations, support staff are also a must. This includes cooks, plumbers, mechanics, and doctors. Well, here to join us is one-time local Peter Rizzo, who recently served as Antarctic Medical Practitioner, or station doctor, for 395 days at the Davis Station, part of the 77th Australian National Antarctic Research Expedition. Peter, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. I am very excited to be here.
Well, like I said, you were a one-time local. A lot of people were probably listening going, why is Peter Rizzo on the air?
Yeah.
But nothing to fear. So let's start with, how did you end up in Antarctica?
Well, I left Park City to become a doctor. And I ended up graduating in emergency medicine out of SUNY Downstate Brooklyn, Kings County Hospital. And as part of my celebration, I went on a rugby tour. For those of you who don't know, I was also a Park City Mucker, the long-time rugby team here. And as part of my celebration, I went over to Australia on a rugby tour. And, well, a little bit stayed behind, and I found out I was going to be a father. So I moved to Australia, and there I practiced emergency medicine, and I had always wanted to go to Antarctica. My grandmother went in 1973. She brought back an album, a vinyl album that was Sounds of the Antarctic, and it was 3 minutes of emperor penguins, 3 minutes of a storm, 3 minutes of an icebreaker. And I'm thinking, thanks, Grandma. And I'd kill to have that album back again. But what was really cool is that when I was out on the ice, I remember her hearing the crack of the ice floes. And I had everybody be quiet for a minute. And I recorded my own crack of the ice floes, which was this great big deep doop, doop. It was fantastic.
So you ended up as the medical practitioner, like I said, or station doctor at the station. I'm guessing you probably had a few more roles besides just probably emergency appendectomies and, you know, fixing broken shoulders.
Yeah, what's interesting is that even though I am a board-certified emergency medicine doctor, that doesn't actually put me high up in the list. What does put someone high up in the list is being a general practitioner in a rural and remote area. We call them rural GPs and family practice folk. And right now I'm practicing in the booming town of Scottsdale, Tasmania of 2000. We have a hospital, which makes us booming. So the rural and remote GP deal with a lot of emergencies and things, but it's the fact that in the summer you've got 60 to 70 people living very closely together, and in the winter you've got maybe 18 to 27, 28 in our case, over the winter, and it is a very long time. And there are a lot of emotional challenges. People had their parents die while they're down there. Divorces occur while people are down there. Dogs die. You know, it's all life continues. And one is in Antarctica for 9 months when you're overwintering.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with one-time local. I like that one-time. How about long-time-ago local, yeah. Peter Rizzo. We all came to Park City in our 20s, the three of us sitting here. And it's always interesting for Katie and for me to see where people have gone in their lives and what they have done. And this is a particularly interesting one, I think. And, you know, if we can relate it back to Cool Science Radio, really interesting to hear about the 44 research stations out there. Can you give us just an overview of what your research station was doing, the 77th Australian National Antarctic Research Expedition was doing?
Well, the 77th NRA has been largely concerned with getting all the science back up to speed. COVID really wreaked havoc because just a lot of infrastructure would get badly damaged. A lot of that needed to be rebuilt. But in the broadest sense, the Australian Antarctic Program concerns itself with weather. There have been four research stations down there that have been doing weather research for over 70 years. We do one of the 200 ozone balloon releases every week. So there's four stations that will do that. We are also, of course, part of the twice daily balloon research. We have all the weather radar. There's four huge radar arrays down at Davis. We also have laser beams, and they shoot lasers up into the sky to really get some great imagery back. They also have been doing extensive sea ice research. That's been going on for at least 30 years. So every week we go out to various locations out on the fast ice, and that is the ice that surrounds Antarctica. It is called fast ice because it is made fast to land, right? So that's it. It's fast ice. It doesn't form any faster or slower. It's just made fast so you can walk and drive out onto the many kilometers of ice that surrounds the whole continent, and upon which there is a huge amount of biomass which regenerates every year underneath the ice. So, for example, there's a lot of algae that will collect on the undersurface of the freshwater ice. And then as that ice does melt, that algae then becomes available to the krill, or the phytoplankton, and the phytoplankton to the krill, and the krill to whale.
Wow. That's
and
pretty incredible.
Penguins. Oh, it's unbelievable. And the great thing is that it's this incredible cycle that we've learned. Everything sloshes from one side of the globe to the other in the currents.
So when you come back stateside or go back to Australia, What are those things? I mean, we get it that you're a rural and remote. Do you consider yourself at this point a rural and remote general practitioner? Did you get that certification?
Well, no, actually, I've had to go back to doctor school.
Oh.
And I'm learning how to become a GP or a family practitioner. Because while emergency medicine is related to a lot of stuff, it has its own body of knowledge and own examination procedures and stuff. And because I've gotten a little bit tired with the larger scale and politics of emergency medicine in the cities, I've really come to enjoy the smaller thing and continuity of care. So I'm no longer swanning in to say yes, see your GP, unless you've got, you know, a tractor injury. I am now learning that softer, more intricate side, which was a huge component of being a doctor in Antarctica. And then we'd also kill time doing things like carpentry and painting, which is stuff I learned here too.
Well, let's talk about some of the support that goes into creating these bases and keeping these bases running. We were talking last night, and you mentioned that there's everything from plumbers and mechanics and a brewery on site?
Oh, yes. There used to be a brewery. Yeah, actually, every station had a brewery. There were some issues that came up regarding alcohol abuse, quite honestly, and in a political move, these were all crushed one day, and everything, all the breweries had to be dismantled, which was unfortunate. Because even the non-drinkers, those that just enjoyed the camaraderie, they'd be sitting around making the mash. And many of us here in this studio right now would sit up at Wasatch Brew Pub and watch Michael Begay do the mash, and we all made our home brews. And so I was ready, and only to discover that the year before, this rather draconian measure has been introduced. However, science is saying, actually, this draconian approach is not really in the best interest of the expeditioners. So things are easing in a lot of ways, and there's talk about reinstating a brewery.
Well, like I said in the intro, there's plumbers, mechanics, physicians, and scientists. Would all of you non-science people find yourselves out helping with the data and the research and the discoveries besides just doing your assigned role?
Yeah, the scientists that we had, remember, this was largely a rebuilding year. So we only had a couple of scientists in the weather folk, the Bureau of Meteorology, but they loved having us come in. They also knew that people could become marginalized in these things, so they made sure they talked to the construction engineers and say, right, find me two guys for Thursday afternoon ice drilling. And they would do that every week. And all the bomb folk, the Bureau of Meteorology, probably at great risk of bodily harm and violation of multiple international treaties, would get everybody to release a weather balloon. You know, and these things are huge, and they fill them up with helium and or hydrogen, and you had to wear special anti-static suits. It's actually quite a production to do these things. And so everybody got really into that. And even if you weren't doing that specifically, but you were working on the radar array, you know, you got to climb radar towers and things in Antarctica, which was so cool. I mean, everybody loved that.
Absolutely. It's so interesting that you're in such an isolated part of the world, and yet your skill set probably expanded, you know, by four times or something because of that isolation and the relative need to perform all of these duties. That's really cool.
Yeah, I tell you, the guys and gals that work there are not slackers by any means. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who'd like to get down there, and there's pretty rigorous emotional, psychological, and physical qualifications. So you've got to be able to do your job well. And I just worked with the most incredible people, electricians that would keep the power running, the plant operators, you know, the guys that run the backhoes and the diggers and the big trucks and stuff, because it's a small city.
Yeah.
And everybody was there like-minded. But there's always, you know, the challenges that can then get people a little stir-crazy in some ways and sad. You know, but everybody was still on the page of the science. Everybody still recognized that we are collectively are advancing some of the greatest information, discovering every year we're advancing on projects that have been going for 70, 40 years. And that's the kind of stuff that can't get lost. Mm. You interrupt that data. And now they're still working on new ones, like the million-year ice core.
Oh, which we'll hear about in a minute here. But I want to ask more about the ozone. You know, so you were down there for a year and 3 months or so as part of this expedition, as an armchair scientist, I guess, or not really armchair, a field scientist and a physician, because you were out there in the field launching those balloons. But when you come back, what do you find that you learned about the ozone down there that most people here have no idea of?
All right. So a deep breath, because there's so much cool stuff. When you open a freezer door, you know how you see all the cold air fall out? Okay. Well, all the air over the Antarctic gets cold and it drops. That's what causes the high pressure system. I always thought high pressure went up into the air. It's actually because it's cold, it drops and squashes the air onto the earth, right? So when that air squashes down onto the earth, that will then create these katabatic winds, which are cold air fed by gravity that then just starts to extend out towards the equator. And there's all these circles and eddies and everything else, like any kind of a liquid, because gas is a liquid, it needs a container. And so with respect to the ozone, because that whole thing affects the fast ice and acryl and all of that sort of stuff. But if you then look at the polar regions, when that air drops, all of that needs to be filled in again. And depending on what pollutants are in the air or whatever. Honestly, it gets a little beyond my understanding, but all that air needs to be sucked back in, and it is the winter that reestablishes that ozone layer. What we have found, though, is that it's not even just the ozone, it's that larger circulation of mass air that just extends all the way up to the equator. And that will then start cooling the different water surfaces and cause krill to drop down in, and that's their big life cycle. Apparently, the krill have a huge contribution to CO2 sequestration. And yes, krill poop absorbs a lot of CO2 and drops down to the ocean. And then, of course, their life cycle, as they consume a lot of the phytoplankton and everything else that's there. I didn't do it justice just now, but it is huge.
I just want to clarify, because on the katabatic winds, so this is kind of what I understood. Mm-hmm. And then maybe because you were trying to choose the right words as well to explain it. So there's this downward pressure that's greater than it would be here.
Correct.
And it creates these
eddies.
These eddies. But does that give a higher concentration of, like, you know, you're talking about during the industrial age, you know, you could see each stage of it. Is there a greater concentration of these gases that are in the ozone on each pole because of the pressure in the ozone?
Yeah, so there is definitely a vortex effect there. And because the Earth spins within the atmosphere and it spins slower, a lot of that sort of will collect at the poles. Whereas out by the equator, a lot of things spin faster. And it's in fact that discrepancy of speeds that allows things like trade winds to develop. So you've got relatively slow moving air, angular momentum, all the physics kids will love that, versus the relatively higher speed. And a lot of that will cause that sort of twisting. And that twisting will also contribute to the eddies currents and the general travel and collection of air, repletion of the ozone during different times of the year at the different poles.
Okay. And so that's why you see more climate scientists at the poles than you do at the equator, because there's just more data.
Exactly.
Okay.
You're going to hit much more extremes there. And the layering is so much more dramatic. So the thermosphere, the ionosphere, all of those become easily distinguishable.
Well, I was reading about Davis Station, and it's in a very unique part of Antarctica that makes it really good for setting up a base. Tell us about what it is about Davis Station.
Davis Station is one of the largest snow and ice-free areas in Antarctica during the summer. And it's like walking on Mars. And in fact, people have compared the imagery of Mars and Davis. One is there's a blue sky and the other there's a black sky. And the terrain is comprised of all sorts of boulders because there's a huge amount of glacial, as we know, the tectonic plates and things moving. There's been a lot of glacier pulling rock and debris down. And so it's a very, very rugged terrain with a fair few hills independent of the glaciers that are there behind it. So that katabatic wind will come by and scour that section that's about 25 kilometers across of all the snow and debris. So even in the middle of winter, you can't cross-country ski across great. And the other thing is you can't walk without looking down. You can't, because the entire range is comprised of rocks, the smallest of which being golf balls, but most of them about the size of two boots put together. And so there's no easy place to step. You have to look where you're stepping every time. And a broken ankle out there will kill you.
Well, let's talk about winter. You just brought that up. You know, we're used to, it's summer down there right now, but with the winter, you would go months, weeks, yeah, without even seeing any sunlight at all?
Yeah.
How, as a physician and a human, how did you handle that?
That was really something. So Davis Station is 68 degrees south, which puts us below the Antarctic Circle, which means that at about June 1st, the sun didn't rise until about July, the end of July. So we would get light, and at June 28th or so, you could see at high noon, as it were, but it wasn't easy. And it was interesting because, at least for us, it was a gradual descent into darkness, where if you go down to McMurdo or the South Pole, they will drop into darkness for longer periods of time much more quickly. So we were also incredibly lucky because Davis did have clear skies, auroras like you wouldn't believe. There is something really fascinating about having a cup of coffee, standing outside 30 below at 8 in the morning, having a cup of coffee, looking at these auroras, and they move like smoke. And unfortunately, it's 30 degrees in your coffee and you get cold very quickly. Mm. But we would spend a lot of time out there, and we would go to the various field huts to do maintenance work. And like I said, this year we didn't get a chance to do much science out by these huts, but we still went out, had to maintain them because Antarctica is unlike any other place in the world. And if things go wrong, they stay wrong and keep going wrong until they get fixed. And we'd go out to the huts and on the weekends or wherever and have a great time.
I wanted to ask you about the cold and our relative ability to adapt to it. I don't know if you know this guy, Wim Hof, the Dutch guy.
Oh, yes.
You know, who puts himself in freezing cold water for, you know, I don't know how long. A long time. Most of us would get hypothermic, but there's something that he's got about mind control, which has always confounded me because it's like, well, mind over matter. Cold is cold. So how do people adapt to it, and is there a mind over matter component?
Interestingly, so one of the things that any doctor that goes down to Antarctica with the Australian Antarctic Division is trained by the Polar Medicine Unit, and I had 4 months of training before we went, and it is a dump truck of information in the morning, and you come up gasping for air, and it's another dump truck in the afternoon. And one of those was the Wim Hof, because there are a number of people that will try to take this opportunity to better themselves in some way. And largely, that's okay. The extremes, like Wim Hof and stuff, can be problematic. One of the things that we are very keen on is science, real science with reproducible data and the Wim Hof effect. Now, what they found is that many people can psychologically adapt themselves to the cold, but the body doesn't really. And if you go down into the cold and you are one of those people, regardless of how gently you do this, you are still going to suffer the hypothermic shock. And so, you know, we discovered that most of the people that drowned in our Titanic did so within 10 minutes because they just couldn't swim. Your muscles become frozen. And we saw videos of people, Olympic swimmers in England, in 4-degree water, which is still much warmer than the water we have. And after 10 minutes, they literally had to be hauled out of the pool they were in. And they just couldn't do it. One made it 8, one made it 9. And they repeated these studies. So we actively discourage people trying to do that sort of stuff, because if something goes wrong, sure, I'm there and I've got a lot of training and I have some really good facilities, but I don't have an ICU. And if I need help, well, help is only a phone call away. There's nothing else. And there's no help for, in some cases, 9 months. The expeditioners have been known to spend 9 months with a broken ankle. And we apparently, the doctor did a great job. But, you know, we've got preparations to do X-fixes and emergency appendectomies and all of that sort of stuff. So anyway, back to Wim Hof. We want to make sure that people don't start wading into the water in the summer. We do have a sponsored swim, which is the Australia Day and the Midwinter Swim. So in Australia Day, the water is negative 1.8 degrees Celsius because it's salty and it doesn't freeze at the same temperature, and all the fresher water freezes on top. In the summer, though, the ice flow had already, the fast ice had broken out. And in the winter, the fast ice had remained. And we had a chainsaw with a 6-foot bar because we needed to cut through nearly a meter and a half of ice to make a little pool. And we had to wear gloves and boots so our hands and feet didn't stick to the ladder getting in and out.
No, thank you. So, Peter, what other programs or organizations do you work with and the Australian group work with when you're down there in Antarctica?
Well, one of the great things is that Antarctica is such a perfect analog for space, right? We work in an extreme and isolated and remote environment that, NASA works with us closely. In fact, two of the experiments that I worked on made it up into the Polaris Dawn a few weeks ago. So one of the things that we did was look at body morphology, body fat composition, using iPhones.
Really? But
yeah, it started a few years ago using LIDAR, because instead of trying to sink people into water and figure out fat muscle composition and do all the tape measures and stuff, we did the tape measure stuff and then compared it to LIDAR. And we would walk around a subject and get incredible detail on body shape. And they did it to see what would happen to people who are in an area for 9 months. And we did it with the summers and the winters. The other one we did was ultrasonography. So, for example, as the space, hopefully the space program continues to expand, you can't send a doctor up with every single mission, right? So what they are trying to do is develop eyes and ears for the doctor on the ground, so that, much like telehealth we all know today, and they're trying to get the astronauts. Now, astronauts are nothing but glorified tradies. I mean, let's face it, right? Mission control specialist, electronics engineer. They're an electrician, right? They're a very, very, very high-achieving electrician, right? And the computer guys and gals and the builders, right? All those engineers are the same folk as in Antarctica. So they ask these Antarctic folk, can you drive an ultrasound? Can you identify the gallbladder? So if somebody comes in with abdominal pain, if we can see that the gallbladder is the issue, then that makes life a lot easier and we know it's not appendicitis. There's different ways to treat it. Has somebody had a retinal detachment? So could they look at the back of the eye? How is the heart functioning? So we did all these different things and compared that. So the astronauts were supposed to do that too, but they didn't do as good a job as we did. So yes, the tradies in Australia rule. Yeah, and that is just some of the stuff that we do. And that's my other job, is a huge amount of research that the Australian Antarctic medical practitioner will contribute to science.
Peter, tell us about the million-year ice core?
Oh, the million-year ice core project.
Yeah, tell us about the million-year ice core project before we let you go.
Yeah, so the idea of gases being incorporated into waters or solutions is very well known. And if you were to take snow from the top of Park City today, you would be able to determine what gases and pollutants and little stuff, volcanic ash, whatever, was in that ice today. So for 30 years now, I think they've been working on this project and from its inception. And the idea is to find a valley, which they finally did. The French did as well. And it's a valley on the continent of Antarctica where glacier ice has been sitting on top of it. And the idea is to drill down until you get to a million-year core. And when you pull out the million-year core, you'll have an understanding of what gases, what was the ratio of carbon dioxide to nitrogen to oxygen, what plant life was around, what had affected that. Interestingly, when they started the project and they were experimenting, they predicted to the year the kind of impact that the Industrial Revolution had, just because it's every year the dropping of that really cold air and the moisture onto the glaciers that is Antarctica, like I told you before, that contributing to the katabatic winds. So all of that stuff that's floating around in the atmosphere, remember, which goes all the way up to the North Pole and back again and drops down, ends up in that ice.
Our guest today has been long ago local, Peter Rizzo. He served as medical practitioner at the Davis Station in Antarctica as part of the 77th Australian National Antarctic Research Expedition. Peter, it's been great to see you and so great to have you in studio. Thanks for sharing your stories of Antarctica.
Thank you very much. It's been a blast. Great to see you both.
Thanks, Peter. Oh, that was fun to see Peter Rizzo and chat with him about Antarctica. It's always fun to follow those longtime locals and where they've gone off to in the world. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.